This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. House Republicans last week passed a hastily put together bill under the banner of the American Health Care Act after months of embarrassment over failing to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A small number of Republicans joined the Democrats in voting against the bill, but it still passed with a few votes to spare. Lawmakers did not even wait for the Congressional Budget Office to publish the bill's fiscal impact before voting on it. The bill leaves in place some aspects of Obamacare, but makes large cuts in Medicaid and undermines the pre-existing coverage ban, among other things. Now, 13 Republican senators are working to craft their own version of the bill for the Senate and have come under criticism for being unable to find a single female senator to join their all-male team. The GOP has only a slim majority in the Senate, so passage could be challenging. My guest is David Dayan, contributor to The Nation and The Intercept, and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His latest book is called Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Sonali.
So let's first go through what exactly the Republican House bill has in it, because there has been a lot of misinformation. There have been some hysterical pronouncements over what the bill does do and doesn't do. Democrats have exaggerated the impacts of the bill. Republicans have also downplayed the impact. So let's first talk about what I think is the most controversial aspect of the bill, which is the issue of pre-existing conditions. When the Affordable Care Act was being put together, that was one of the things that made Americans the angriest, and with good reason, because it used to be we had a time when insurance companies could simply charge you more if you had cancer or, you know, something even less serious. And the Affordable Care Act did away with the ability of insurance companies to do that. What does the House bill allow insurance companies to do?
Well, the House bill allows states to apply for waivers whereby if a state acquires this waiver, they would allow an insurance company to charge more for a patient based on their health status. So this doesn't necessarily, technically it doesn't, you know, change the pre-existing condition exclusion. But if you can charge more based on a health status, you know, the insurer can just jack up that price as much as possible to essentially price people who are sick out of the market. Now, according to the bill that was passed, this would only be possible if an individual had a lapse in their health insurance coverage. However, you know, it's very easy for an insurance company to just raise prices overall, which they're not restricted from doing within the American Health Care Act, and price out the poor out of the market, which creates that lapse in coverage. And of course, we know that poor people are correlated with people that have, you know, pre-existing conditions, have existing health problems. So there's a way for insurance companies to essentially ensure that their risk pool includes healthier people rather than sicker people, and they can use a number of mechanisms within the law to do that. Of course, it's only if states take that waiver that they would be enabled to run this system.
Now, how does the bill define what a pre-existing condition is, or are the list of pre-existing conditions that are making people angry and nervous, are those the lists that insurance companies used to use to determine whether you had a pre-existing condition?
Right, they were what the insurance companies used. If you know, a state gets that waiver, an insurance company would sort of have to work up another list. I think it's plausible that they would go off past practice and use that list of conditions to make their considerations in terms of what they could charge, you know, based on health status. So I don't think it's terribly alarming to use that past issue. The other problem here is that within this waiver, states could change what is known as the essential health benefits package. And this is what makes insurance actually look like insurance. You know, in the past, before the Affordable Care Act, insurers were selling coverage that really didn't do a whole lot at all. It didn't cover a number of different basic kind of medical conditions. And the Affordable Care Act created this essential health benefits package and said, if you're selling insurance, you have to cover these 10 things. And that includes maternity, that includes, basic preventive care, it includes a number of very basic things. The waiver would allow insurers to sell coverage that doesn't have those essential health benefits. In fact, the state would get to mandate what goes into that consideration and what goes out. And so you would have coverage that would be sort of coverage in name only. This, if you get a hit by a bus coverage, kind of insurance coverage in those states that opt to go for that waiver.
Right. So basically insurance companies, and we're talking about the individual market here, not employer-based insurance, but people who are, say, self-employed or unemployed or work in companies that are too small to offer health insurance, this is who these things would affect. Let's actually talk about the individual mandate and the employer mandate. Those were two things that the Affordable Care Act required individuals to have health insurance or pay a fine. It also required companies over having more than 50 employees to offer health insurance. What does the Republican bill do for those two aspects?
Well, it eliminates the individual and the employer mandates. However,
just eliminates them.
Yeah, it repeals them, but there's this continuous coverage provision that we talked about earlier, and that's kind of a version of the individual mandate. The difference is that instead of paying a fine to the government if you don't acquire health care throughout the year, you would have to pay a larger penalty to the insurance company in form of larger prices if you have a lapse in coverage and then you try to get it again. They can charge you extra for that. And that's intended to keep people within the system. But if people fall out of the system, it's a great incentive to not get health care coverage. And this is why when the Congressional Budget Office first looked at an early version of this bill, which did have this continuous coverage provision, it said that 24 million people would lose their coverage. And about half of that was because of this continuous coverage provision and how it would create incentives to not get coverage if you got dropped from coverage. The other thing we need to talk about is the subsidies. Right now, there are subsidies that are sort of based on income on a sliding scale that help you pay for your health insurance coverage. The new subsidies that the American Health Care Act would bring in are not based on income. They're based mostly on age. And so they are kind of uniform. So a 55-year-old who makes $10,000 a year and a 55-year-old who's Bill Gates gets the same amount of money under the American Health Care Act. And that money is far too small to deal with the increased coverage and the increased price of health insurance.
And that was one of the most important aspects of the Affordable Care Act, right? In terms of attempting to make health insurance affordable for people who couldn't afford it, that the government would subsidize. And of course, this went into the pockets of the insurance companies, but poor people did have access to coverage that they didn't have access to before.
Right. And under the American Health Care Act, poorer people will get less support while relatively richer people will get support where they got none before with this sort of refundable tax credit that is set up through the program. So if you're sicker and poorer, you're going to be hurt by the American Health Care Act. If you're richer and healthier, you're going to be helped. And I'm not sure that what problem that really solves in the healthcare system overall.
Let's talk about Medicaid. This is another huge aspect of the House bill that essentially would disproportionately impact or entirely impact Poor people and disabled Americans who currently have access to Medicaid, right? Explain what the cuts are and over how long a period does this bill require cuts to take place?
Right. So this really is a complete overhaul of the Medicaid program. Right now, the way Medicaid works is that states have rules for who is eligible for Medicaid, and whoever signs up gets coverage if they meet the eligibility requirements. And then the federal government sends out the money, and that goes up and down based on how many people are within the system. This would, what is known as block grant the program. It would give a set amount to the states rather than a rolling amount based on eligibility and coverage. And then the states would just have to deal with that set amount. And the Congressional Budget Office found that this would cut Medicaid over a 10-year period by $880 billion. And there's no way to do that without cutting people's coverage and throwing people off the Medicaid rolls. CBO said it would throw 14 million people off the Medicaid rolls. This also rolls back the expansion of Medicaid, which was responsible for half of the coverage gains in the Affordable Care Act. And that savings is almost directly plowed into repealing all of the taxes that were used to pay for the Affordable Care Act, all of which affected the top 2% or higher of income earners in this country and large corporations like health insurance companies and medical device companies. So it's almost a one-for-one split. We're going to cut back Medicaid by $800 billion, and we're going to take that money and give it back to rich people who were paying for the coverage issues and subsidies within the Affordable Care Act.
So how was it that the House finally got enough of its members to agree on this version of the bill? What did they change from previous versions that they didn't even bother to vote on because they knew it would fail? What did they do to appease the Freedom Caucus, the so-called Tea Party wing of their party? And how did they get their moderates who were actually worried about their constituents losing coverage to agree?
Right. So the first bill crashed and burned because the Freedom Caucus was angry that it didn't do anything on pre-existing conditions or on these essential health benefits. And that's where this amendment came in, which allowed these state waivers. That is what brought the conservative hardline Freedom Caucus along. You would think that degrading the pre-existing condition rules within the Affordable Care Act would have, if it brought in people on the hard right, it would lose people on the moderate side. But that is not what happened. Instead, moderates secured this amendment called the Upton Amendment, named for Fred Upton, who's one of the key moderates here, which added $8 billion over 5 years to help people who see spikes in their coverage because of their pre-existing condition to help pay that down.
So subsidies.
It's $8 billion in subsidies, which is nothing. I mean, $8 billion is, by some estimates, 90% less than what would be needed deal with the increase in cost to people with pre-existing conditions in these states that accept that waiver. And yet, it was enough of a fig leaf that moderates said, okay, well, we got $8 billion. I can point to that and say nobody's going to be affected. And there you go. This is why in an article for The Nation, I called this particular provision of the bill single payer for dummies. I mean, think about what you're doing here. You're breaking the market in the individual market so that people with pre-existing condition would have to pay a lot more. And then you're taking federal money, government money, to create a government-run system to subsidize the market you just broke. But instead of in single payer, where there's a government-run system that centralizes healthcare and allows the government to bargain down the cost of healthcare, you are then, in this case, just leaking out that federal money to a private actor, the insurance companies, who would have every reason to continue to jack up prices because they know they're going to get paid for it out of a taxpayer kitty.
Right. In fact, they'd be stupid to not jack up their prices because they've been told that money is available to them to simply line their profits.
That's absolutely right. So this is the exact opposite of what a single payer system is supposed to do, which is reduce costs in the system. This would increase costs in the system by design, and accomplishes none of the goals that we're supposed to be going toward in healthcare.
And this, of course, being highly ironic, given that single payer continues to be hugely popular across partisan lines. I want to just stay for a moment on what the American Healthcare Act does, what the Republicans passed last week. How does it disproportionately impact women? We know, for example, women are slapped with a lot of the pre-existing conditions issue. Before the Affordable Care Act passed, they were disproportionately impacted. But they were also being charged more for health plans, and the Affordable Care Act stopped that. Does the American Healthcare Act overturn those protections of women?
Well, this really goes back to this essential health benefits issue.
Right.
Because a lot of in prior versions of the insurance market, a lot of these women's issues like mammograms or screening or particular
pregnancy, childbirth,
pregnancy, maternity, yes, they weren't covered in a standard benefits package. And that's what Obamacare changed. It said, look, you gotta put those kinds of things in the essential health benefits package. And if that's broken, and suddenly being a woman is a pre-existing condition again, right? Or, you know, the maternity isn't covered unless you pay extra within a policy, you're going to get that same kind of thing that we saw in the past where women were simply charged more because they might utilize more healthcare and more treatment.
And David, I think you said it just right. In the Republican world, literally simply being a woman is a pre-existing condition.
That's Nancy Pelosi popularized that that statement. Right. And that's really what it would be if you strip away these essential health benefits and make it sort of an a la carte policy. So men obviously wouldn't have to, put pregnancy in their essential health benefits, the package they put together. But women, any woman thinking of being, they might be pregnant at some point, would have to. So that's the problem.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about what the fallout, the political fallout for the Republican Party will be. It was Republican constituents that were very upset, alongside progressives, that were very upset the last time the Republicans tried to rally support for a healthcare bill. They were confronted at their town hall meetings by angry constituents. They were dismissed as paid protesters. But the Republican Party went ahead and did this anyway. Some imagine that it's political theater because they want to be able to say that they did something. The Senate may not get to pass a version of the bill, but at least House Republicans could claim they tried. What will the fallout be for particularly those Republicans who are in vulnerable districts where, say, Trump won or even lost districts and Hillary Clinton won?
Yeah, I think the fallout's going to be significant. You mentioned those districts. There were 23 districts where Hillary Clinton actually beat Donald Trump, but they have a Republican representative member of Congress. And I believe it's either 14 or 15 of those districts, the representative voted for the American Healthcare Act. The Cook Political Report, which is an observer of federal elections and midterm elections in particular, moved 20 races into the Democrats' favor after the passage of the bill. It's simply going to be something much like the 2010 elections that Democrats can point to and say that your representative voted to, in this case, voted to take away the health care of 24 million people. I mean, this it's much harder, I would say, to take something away from a constituent than to give them something. And people resist that. There are rare moments in history when you've seen an earned benefit like this taken away from the public, and that usually creates some sort of backlash. The estimates that I've seen are anywhere between 40% and 50% that Democrats will return the House to their control in 2018. Obviously, it's very early. There's a long way to go. We don't know how this bill is going to go. A lot of this remains to be seen. But I do think that there will be significant fallout because this is a very unpopular bill. I mean, every time it's been studied, it gets support somewhere in some cases, the teens. 18%, 17% support for the American Health Care Act. So if you go ahead and pass something like that, you're going to get a backlash.
So let's talk about the Senate and what they're crafting. Are you convinced that the Senate will remain true to the House version of the bill, or are they sort of seeing the potential political fallout and scrambling to craft a less cruel bill that then there will have to be some reconciling with the House version?
Yeah, the Senate's already thrown out the House bill. I mean, the Senate has said, we're going to write our own legislation. There's this gang of 13 that you talked about. 13 men. There are some other gangs, too, that have some women in it that are, you know, thinking about healthcare, at least, or writing their own ideas. The Senate's going to take their time. It's going to be a months-long process, I would say, for them to get to something. As you said, there are only 52 senators who are Republicans, 48 Democrats. Under the way in which this bill is being put together, a process known as reconciliation, they only need 50 votes, but that means they can only lose two members, the Republicans.
Can they lose three and have Mike Pence step in? Or
yeah, Mike Pence can step in and break a tie, but you can still only lose two members. So this is kind of on a knife's edge to get the most of the caucus, if not all of them, together on a policy that and then try to sell that to the House. You would have to reconcile that, as you said, with the House, and you have the Freedom Caucus, which is, you know, pretty hardline on a lot of these issues. I think Medicaid is going to be a significant point of contention. There are a lot of senators who represent states that expanded Medicaid. If you're talking about Ohio, West Virginia, even Arkansas, and a number of other states, those senators have already been very vocal that you can't cut Medicaid in this fashion, and particularly cutting the expansion, which already increased coverage and significantly reduced the ranks of the uninsured in these states. So it's going to be a real jigsaw puzzle to find, you know, this happy space where everybody would go ahead and vote for it. It's not impossible. And I would say Democrats need to be extremely vigilant because this process is moving forward. Whether or not they reach the finish line is yet to be determined.
David, just a quick note and a clarification that I think there's some misinformation around whether the House exempted lawmakers from this American Health Care Act applying to them. We know that essentially Congress has taxpayer-funded health care. But did they write in a last-minute exemption, as some reports are suggesting, or is that just something that's a procedural thing that always happens?
They did exempt themselves. However, they passed a bill that was sort of a rider that rolled back that exemption. That will have to get worked out through the Senate and then the House-Senate reconciliation process, but. Yes, it was in there, and they promised to take it out, and then they didn't. And then there was an amendment that was put on the floor that rolled back that exemption, which every member of Congress voted for. So they
on
were
on principle.
Obviously, given the attention that generated, members of Congress wanted to be very clear that they weren't exempting themselves or their staff.
And of course, members of Congress are disproportionately wealthier than most Americans. So most of them are going to be able to afford their own out-of-pocket healthcare if this thing were to pass. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the Nation magazine article that you mentioned on our website later today. Thanks, as always, for your analysis.
All right. Thank you, Sonal.
My guest is David Dayan, contributor to The Nation and The Intercept, and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His latest book is called Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.